Broadcasting, its staff, or advertisers. It's time for Israel is Real. Two Israelis putting a human face on all things Israel. Rahel and Sonia focus on life in modern 21st century Israel, telling the stories of ordinary people living in, loving, and in support of an extraordinary land. Israel is Real is a community-supported program featuring interviews with local, national, and international celebrities, personal life stories, and call-ins. Learn a new Hebrew word every week. Israel is Real. Every Friday on 1590 WSMN. Nashua's News and Talk. And now, your hosts, Rahel and Sonia.
Good morning. We're Rahel.
And Sonia.
And this is Israel is Real, the free voice for Israel. Boker Tov lekol ha'mazinim.
Tzoraim tovim b'Yisrael.
From WSMN 1590, Nashua's News and Talk. You can hear us also on the internet at WSMNradio.com and always find us on our archives and on our own website at www.israelisraelnh.com. Israelisrael.com. Israel is real.
NH.com.
All right. We are happy to be here again today on a beautiful Friday afternoon in New Hampshire.
Yep.
She says. Let's go right into it because we have a wonderful guest today. And let's start with our Hebrew word.
Musar.
Musar.
Musar, it's coming from the word meser. And meser means message. However, musar means a message with a value, which is equal to ethics.
Ethics. That sounds like a heavy topic today.
Yes, exactly.
Let me go right in and introduce our guest, who will be soon with us. Our honored guest today is Alex Safian. He's the Associate Director and Research Director at CAMRA, and he holds a Bachelor of Science from Columbia University and a Master's and a PhD from Harvard University. He served as a postdoctoral fellow at Northeastern University and an instructor at Harvard University before joining CAMRA. Mr. Safian's articles have appeared in the Wall Street Journal, the Boston Globe, the San Diego Union Tribune, the Jerusalem Post, Newsmax, National Review Online, as well as in other newspapers and magazines across the United States, and he has published articles in the Middle East Quarterly and other academic journals. He's lectured widely in the United States, Canada, and Israel on many subjects, and especially on the subject of media coverage of the Middle East, and on topics such as Middle East history, the strategic balance between Israel and her neighbors, water and lack of water in the Middle East, human rights in Israel and the neighboring states. He's also been a frequent guest on radio programs and television programs across the country, including PBS's NewsHour. Alex Safian is the author of the monograph PBS and Israel, A Pattern of Bias, A Case of Journey to the Occupied Lands, and he was invited to testify before an appropriations subcommittee of the United States Congress documenting taxpayer-funded anti-Israel bias in the programming of the Public Broadcasting Service and in broadcasts of national public radio. What a resume. We are very, very honored to have with us today Mr. Alex Safian. Alex, Boker Tov.
Oh, Boker Tov. Thank you very much. Very nice to be with you.
Boker Tov.
It's nice to have you.
Thank you for coming.
Well, thank you for asking.
Let's start off just a little bit about telling our listeners about CAMRA. We've had many guests from CAMRA, but you really are the Associate Director of CAMRA. So tell us a little bit about CAMRA, its missions, its goals, its activities.
Well, CAMRA is the first and the largest Middle East-related media watch group. CAMRA started around 1983 in Washington, D.C., because of incredibly unbalanced and unfair coverage in the Washington Post of Israel's incursion into Lebanon. The Washington Post really was just you wouldn't believe it to go back and read some of those stories about how they were covering that and how they were trying to portray Israel as bloodthirsty murderers, and, you know, just going there to slaughter innocent people, supposedly, rather than defending itself against a massive terrorist group that had taken over Lebanon, which is what really happened. That's not the way the Washington Post wanted to report it. And so a grassroots group came together in Washington of, prominent local citizens in the Washington area who wanted to do something about it. And so that's how CAMERA got started. And it stayed in Washington for about 7 or 8 years until, for various reasons, the Boston chapter of CAMERA, which had existed for a couple of years by around 1990, took over and became the main office. And that's the way it's been ever since. The chapters have closed down. We now have professional offices in a number of places in Washington, D.C., in Los Angeles, in New York, and in Israel. And the Boston office is the main office of CAMERA.
Excellent. And how did you become involved with CAMERA?
I was actually I had gotten my PhD at Harvard and was a postdoctoral fellow in Boston and saw something in a newspaper that I thought was outrageous, a local newspaper, not the Boston Globe, but something called the Tab Newspapers, which are still around. It's a local weekly. And I just, this thing was so outrageous that I decided to do something about it and started researching some of the facts needed for a rebuttal. And one particular fact was difficult, and one thing led to another. I started making some phone calls, and finally somebody said, why don't you call CAMERA? And so I did, and so that's how I came to know CAMERA and eventually went to work for them.
I'm wondering if you can offer any reason for the massive flow of biased reporting against Israel?
Well, I think there are many, many reasons. One thing that you can't get away from is that Israel is the Jewish state. And so I don't want to, I'm not going to
much
say
as people
that,
would like to try.
Yeah, I'm not going to say that it's all anti-Semitism and, you know, period, because I don't believe that's true, and I think that's too easy an answer. But I think that is part of it, and some of it is because it's Jewish state, but I wouldn't call it anti-Semitism. There are some people who are, you know, could be very friendly to Jews, but are not comfortable with the idea of Jewish sovereignty, whether they realize it or not. You know, they're not comfortable or accepting of the idea that Jews can have sovereignty. And that, you know, there can be countries where the Christians are sovereign or the Muslims are sovereign, but somehow if the Jews are sovereign, then that's wrong. Another thing I would say is that there's something that only Israel really faces, and that is that there are hundreds of these nonprofit organizations, NGOs, around the world, not just in the States, who are focused on Israel, either entirely or mostly, and who put Israel under a microscope that no other country faces, even the United States doesn't face this, churn out material about how bad Israel is on every imaginable topic. What is water policy in Israel? What is land policy? What about discrimination? What about the number of Israeli Arabs who get admitted to Hebrew University? You know, I mean, on and on and on. No other country faces this level of scrutiny. And I'll give you one example. Mm-hmm. There is, of course, a Jewish group called the New Israel Fund.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Where mm-hmm. is the New Korea Fund? Where is the New Ireland Fund? Why do we need a New Israel? Is the existing Israel so bad? Mm-hmm. Where is the New Mexico Fund? Right? None of these things exist. So either there's something odd about the New Israel Fund, or there's something odd about Israel that it's so bad that we need a new Israel. Well, whereas we don't need a new Korea or a new Italy.
I think the right? New Israel they're looking at, I mean, I have a little bit of personal experience with the New Israel Fund, and I know that a lot of the money goes towards Palestinian support.
Yes, I mean.
So what is the New Israel they're looking for?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I sometimes call it the No Israel Fund, you know, but no, absolutely. I mean, the New Israel Fund is a complicated topic, but it is absolutely true that they put some money into laudable things, I would say, in order to give themselves cover. Mm-hmm. But a vast amount of money goes into anti-Israel groups in Israel who are filing lawsuits left and right to try to stop the Israeli government from doing things that are perfectly normal for a government to do, just trying to damage the country in every way possible. And that is where a large amount of this money goes, not just soup kitchens and battered women's shelters, which is what they will point fingers to, and, you know, school lunch programs or something. I mean, that's what they want to say they're doing, but the vast majority of the money does not go to that. So, and they're just one example. I mean, I don't mean to pick on them, so to speak, because that's one example. There are so many of these nonprofits. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. Yeah, they devote a huge proportion of their time to looking at Israel. Mm-hmm. Completely disproportionate. And of course, we also have in Israel B'Tselem, which does this, which, you know, it never saw anybody it wanted to call a terrorist, which does its best to blacken Israel. And there are hundreds of other groups like that that many of us have never heard of, but reporters have heard of because they're churning out reports and you know, programs and press availabilities, et cetera. There's Maxom Watch, which I'm sure you've heard of, right. Checkpoint Watch, which they try to portray Israeli checkpoints as somehow discriminating and racist towards Palestinians, whereas they're just trying to stop terrorists. So Maxom Watch is hurting the Israeli effort to stop terrorists,
right,
and creating propaganda at the same time, anti-Israel propaganda. So no country faces this kind of PR assault. And so it's only natural that this PR assault would have an impact. So the next question we would have to ask is, why this PR assault?
Right.
And some of it, frankly, is money. There's money for this.
From where,
right?
The money are coming?
Good question. Well, we saw that Human Rights Watch not too long ago was in Saudi Arabia.
Oh, this is a great place to start looking for human rights.
Yes, exactly. They weren't there to protest against Saudi human rights violations. They were there to raise money. And they weren't speaking with government members, quote unquote. They were speaking with members of the royal family. Of course, everybody knows that's one and the same.
Yeah.
Saudi Arabia is a company town. I mean, it's run by the royal family for the royal family. So if you talk to members of the royal family, you're talking to the government, essentially. But they use that fiction that, oh, we weren't talking to the government, we were talking to prospective donors who were members of the royal family. And they were talking about, you know, how what a microscope they turn on Israel. And the Saudis were only too happy to hear and to consider contributing. So they know where the money is. Human Rights Watch does. Amnesty knows where the money is. I must say, though, of course, they also get quite a bit of Jewish money here in this country, unfortunately.
Sadly.
In fact, the founder of Human Rights Watch, of course, was Jewish. He just recently broke with Human Rights Watch over Israel, because Human Rights Watch was not started about Israel. It was started essentially about the Soviet Union and how it treated refuseniks, et cetera, and how it treated its ethnic minorities. And Bob Bernstein is his name. He just recently, about, I don't know, 8 or 9 months ago, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times essentially denouncing Human Rights Watch for its treatment of Israel.
Really?
And he is starting a competing organization that he feels will be fair to Israel and also honest about human rights. So Israel faces what no other country faces. It's just getting assaulted on the PR front and on the human rights front like no other country.
I would like to just say that, you know, we're talking a little bit about this, the bias and the way that the language really plays a role here. And I think that, you know, journalism is perhaps on trial. It should be on trial in many ways. The language that's being used against Israel, the language that's being used. People believe what journalists say. And journalists can very easily manipulate a situation. We see it in elections, and we see it so strongly against Israel. What do you? What can you say? Can this still be journalism?
I would like to emphasize what Rachel said. It is a hijack of a huge vocabulary, which used to be very common in the communist Russia and in the East Europe in the time of the communism regime. And it's very hard for me to believe that the journalists don't know what they are doing.
I also wanted to say that, you know, the language that's used is specific. You use specific words that mean one thing to one place and something else in another place. And journalists know exactly how to do this, I believe. What do you say?
Well, certainly journalists are experts in the use of language. There's no doubt about that, which is why you often find, for instance, in the New York Times or on National Public Radio, that the groups that attack Israel and specific attacks against Israel are not called terrorist attacks.
Right.
The killers of the Fogel family a few weeks ago in the New York Times was carried out not by terrorists but by intruders.
Right.
And there was a tremendous effort on the part of the New York Times not to call these people terrorists and not to call the groups they are associated with, as it turns out, terrorist groups. There is a terrific effort by the media not to call Hamas a terrorist group. Say, oh, well, you know, there's an armed wing and there's a civilian wing. It's just total nonsense. There are those wings, but they work together hand in hand. It's a terrorist organization, period.
Right.
But many of the media are not willing to do this. They go and interview members of Hamas. These members of Hamas, these leaders, are engineers and doctors. And there's a tremendous tendency on the part of these media types to try to make everything seem like back in the good old USA. So they're not terrorists. They're just members of the city council that I'm talking to in my little town, or they're members of the city council that I'm talking to in Gaza. So there's just this effort to portray people, you know, as if it were here, as if it, you know, as if the Middle East was the Middle West, and it isn't.
I would like to bring an example. In 2003, Dr. Riyad Al-Hassan, the Director General of the Palestinian State Information Service, admitted in an interview that newspapers and journalists can be subjected to, quote, sometimes a little punishment. Can this still be called journalism?
Well, it is definitely true that there have been cases of Western journalists getting beaten up by the Palestinian quote-unquote security services, armed thugs, and they didn't report it. And I remember one case in particular where we reported it because we got a tip that a journalist had been beaten up pretty badly, and he denied it. Now, we had good information and good source that he had been roughed up, but he had his own reasons for denying it, partially because he was probably scared, partially because he wanted to continue working. And if he said that, you know, members of the PA security services, you know, assaulted me, he would be identified as an enemy by them, and he would not be able to work. He would not be able to go into the territories in those days. And so they tend to cover it up. If they get hassled at a checkpoint by Israel, that's a front-page story. But if they get beaten up by the PA security, that's something that they have a reason not to talk about. And, you know, they'll get apologies from Arafat in those days, et cetera. But it was like a mafia leader telling you, oh, I hope you're okay. Hope your family's okay, too. There's a message there. We beat you up, and we'll beat up your family, too, if you don't behave.
Right.
You know, at the same time as they're apologizing, they're sending you a message. You are vulnerable.
Exactly.
You are. Your security depends upon us.
Your personal security, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Right, and many times they are told exactly what to report and how to report it.
Well, they don't have to be. I mean, they don't have to be. They're already on side. You know, there was a famous case a number of years ago where, you know, when those two Israeli soldiers got lynched in Ramallah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And what happened afterwards is that there was one video
made from by an Italian journalist.
That's correct, by an Italian journalist, by an Italian media outlet. And it then showed up on Italian television. And it showed up on the Italian public broadcaster. And the PA then started started threatening the local representative, the local reporter for that broadcaster. And he wrote this incredible letter. His name was Ricardo Cristiani. He wrote this incredible letter saying that, no, I had nothing to do with that. That video was made by a different Italian network, and it was just picked up in Italy by my network, but we did not make that video. That was the other Italian journalists that made that video. And we would never do such a thing. We always operate according to the, you know, rules of the Palestinian Authority. We would never, never do such a thing. Blessings and greetings to you, et cetera. What was really weird is that his letter got published by a Palestinian newspaper, which is how people found out about it. Otherwise, no one would have known. But it got published by a Palestinian newspaper for reasons, who knows, but there it was, and he didn't deny it. And so he eventually was pulled out of the country by his broadcaster because he had no more credibility. But the letter is right there, and, you know, people translated it from, you know, people translated it, and he was not unusual. This is how many of them operate. Not all of them, but this is how many of them operate. They operate hand in glove with the Palestinians, and report things only from their point of view and cover up things that would make them look bad, which is mostly everything.
Alex Safian, we need to cut for a short break, so we will be back with you in a few minutes. We're speaking with Alex Safian of CAMRA, and this is WSMN 1590, Nashua's News and Talk. Israel is real. Wouldn't it be awesome if over 100,000 people, wait, no, let's say millions, knew about your business, your product, or your service? Wouldn't it be even more amazing if you or your business were helping to stop hatred and terrorism by supporting the good news about Israel? You can do this. You can do this by sponsoring a Hebrew Word, the Torah portion, or even a weekly Israel is Real show. So take out your checkbook now, right now. Don't hesitate to make a donation, to call us about advertising, to sponsor a show, or even to have us read a greeting on a special occasion. Happy birthday to you. By supporting Israel is Real, you make a world of difference. Yes, by loving Israel, you will make the world a better place. So take out your checkbook, write a check now to Absolute Broadcasting, and send it to our personal mailbox at Israel is Real, P.O. Box 236, Milford, New Hampshire, 03055. Again, write the check to Absolute Broadcasting. Send it to our personal mailbox at Israel is Real, P.O. Box 236, Milford, New Hampshire, 03055. For rates and more information, you can visit our website, www.israelisrealnh.com. ISRAELNH.com.
Did you know that Vision is an organization that educates our community about the little country of Israel? Did you know Israel is approximately about the size of New Jersey? Did you know how the religious majorities are spread in countries around the world? For example, 56 56 countries are Islamic, 49 are Roman Catholic, 20 are Protestant, 12 are Eastern Orthodox, 4 are Hindu, and 1 is Jewish, almost like Passover. To receive Visions emails alert and be informed about Visions educational activities and opportunities, please visit Visions website at www.newhampshireforisrael.org. That's www.newhampshirenh4israel.org.
Dr. James Haas of Vanguard Dental Group in Derry, New Hampshire, is a board-certified pediatric dentist who is extremely talented at putting anxious children at ease so they have a positive dental experience. Dr. Jim Haas specializes in treating children with special emotional or physical needs by way of sedation and operating room dentistry. Dr. Jim Haas is currently accepting new patients. Your child will enjoy dental visits with Dr. Jim Haas. Call 603-434-1586 or visit www.vanguarddentalgroup.com. That's one long word, vanguarddentalgroup.com, to learn more about Dr. Jim Haas. And speaking about accepting, Congregation Betenu, a Reformed synagogue in Amherst, New Hampshire, is accepting new students, grades 1, actually pre-K, ages 4.5, up to grade 7. Congregation Betenu offers a loving and qualified staff and a warm and welcoming community experience. If you're interested, contact telephone 603-886-1633 or www.betenu.org. That's BETENU.ORG. Yomam Yitzaveh Hashem Chasto Yomam Yitzaveh Hashem Chasto Uva Laila Shiro. This is WSMN 1590 Nashua's News and Talk, and you're listening to Israel is Real, the free voice for Israel with Rachel and Sonia. We're speaking today with Alex Safian of CAMRA. He is the Associate Director and Research Director at CAMRA, www.camra.org. And shalom again, Mr. Hi. Safian. How are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
Good. We wanted to talk a little bit about, I know you've lectured a little bit about this, about the strategic balance between Israel and her neighbors. What can you tell us about that, about one Jewish sovereign state and democratic state and surrounded by an entire league of Arab and Muslim countries, historically and in light of today's changing situation?
Well, strategic balance, I would say there are two major points right now, two major changes from, say, what was true 10 or 15 years ago. One is missiles. And two is what's happening in the Arab world, specifically Egypt, both of which are very problematic from the point of view of Israel. What we have is Gaza, of course, run by Hamas, and we see more and more sophisticated missiles of all types being smuggled into Gaza. And now with the change in regime in Egypt, being much more friendly towards Hamas, the new Egyptian rulers, and that might even accelerate, there's going to be, no doubt, it's going to be much easier to get things into Gaza, including sophisticated weapons of all sorts. And so you've got about half of Israel within the range of missiles fired from Gaza. You've got the other half of Israel and more, three-quarters of Israel from the north, within the range of missiles from Hezbollah, which is essentially the the government of Lebanon, and so Israel is covered by missiles from the north and the south. this is very, very dangerous because it means that there will not be fronts anymore if there is a war. Everything is on the front lines, and Israeli civilians will be the first people targeted in Tel Aviv, in Ashkelon, even in Jerusalem, perhaps. Israeli military bases, Israeli air bases, all of them are in the crosshairs of these missiles from the north and the south. So that is something that is new. And, of course, Israel has reacted to that with defensive systems, among other things, which so far have been, quite effective. But in the face of thousands of missiles being fired, even the defensive systems will probably be overwhelmed. And you have, as I said, the change in governments. Egypt is the most important Arab country. It's the largest and most powerful Arab country, the largest army. Of course, it has been armed by the United States, so it has an extremely modern military. It has, for instance, the M1 tank, which Israel does not have, which is the most advanced American battle tank. And it has the same planes, almost exactly the same planes that Israel has. If Egypt really turns into a hostile state, which it has not been since 1979, but if it turns into a hostile state, that changes everything. All of Israel's defense calculations will change. Now, Israel gave up the Sinai as part of its peace treaty with Egypt. And as people have said, well, if Egypt cancels the peace treaty, do we get the Sinai back? And the answer, of course, is no. Israel traded the Sinai for promises and a piece of paper.
Right.
And if those promises are forgotten and the piece of paper is torn up, you don't get the Sinai back. And so there would be consequences for Egypt, for instance, if they remilitarized the Sinai. They're not supposed to have any large number of troops and no heavy weapons, no tanks, for instance, in the Sinai. If they decide to violate that, there would be consequences from the United States, for instance. But the U.S. would not stop them. The U.S. would penalize them, but the U.S. could not stop them and would not stop them from doing so. And so Israel faces the possibility at some point in the future, a year or two, of having hostile Egyptian forces right back on its border and very, very close to its population centers. That's a very frightening situation. And if Egypt really does go all the way towards a hostile state, they will do everything they can to undermine Jordan and its peace treaty with Israel.
Of course.
So if Egypt goes, Jordan will almost certainly go.
And
so that's a very, very, I mean, that is a nightmare scenario, but it could well happen.
And from the other hand, the quartet, the European quartet, which is pushing for another so-called peace treaty with the Palestinian, when it's clear that on the other side, they do not have any interest for peace.
Well, they're not just pushing for a peace treaty. They're pushing for Palestinian statehood soon, like now. They want it by September. They want it as soon as possible. And what is happening with the British and the French and the Germans in particular is that they are pushing. The way I've described it is that so far the quartet is supposed to be referees, but now the referees are talking about taking part in the game, not just judging the participants in the game, but entering into the game themselves. That's what's happening. The British, the French, and the Germans are meeting among themselves and coming up with their own peace plan that they essentially want to impose upon Israel. And they have in the usual caveats about Israeli security, blah, blah, blah. But the facts on the ground is that this would be very, very dangerous for Israeli security, what they are proposing. And it would violate Resolution 242. It would violate previous agreements and previous assurances to Israel. They don't seem to care. So they are trying to convince the United States to go along with this. And so far the U.S. hasn't said no and it hasn't said yes. Not clear what the U.S. is going to do. But there was just a statement the other day from Hillary Clinton which seemed to indicate some support for the European efforts. Now, this may just be an attempt to pressure Netanyahu. We don't know. But it's a very chilling thing because what it says is, if it actually happens, what it's saying to Israel is that none of these prior agreements that you have signed with the Palestinians, with the Egyptians, with the Americans, mean anything.
Exactly.
They expire in 5 years or 10 years or whatever. So these assurances don't mean anything. And we can just change them. So we can give you solemn assurances. If you do such and such, then we will back you. And then 5 years later, well, that was 5 years ago. Forget it.
Right.
And it's kind of chilling because once Europe gave up on Czechoslovakia, thinking that the war wouldn't start. And now they are trying to push us exactly in the same place.
Well, that's true. I mean, that's something exactly that Prime Minister Sharon said a number of years ago. We are not Czechoslovakia. We're not going to be Czechoslovakia. And a lot of people came down on him for that. And he got criticized by the Americans for that. But, you know, he was right. And he was making the correct point that big powers, in order to avoid unpleasantness today and tomorrow, are willing to sacrifice
somebody else,
other people and other interests.
Exactly.
Just in order to maintain the peace for a while. You know, that is obviously something Israel has to worry about. But we should also recognize that other countries are watching this. For instance, if we are willing to go back on our word to Israel, what do you think the Jordanians are seeing? They're also a small country.
Mm-hmm.
They're also a vulnerable country. They're also a country that has a lot of internal problems with the Palestinians in particular and with Islamists. Hamas and Hezbollah both would like to undo the Hashemite regime and turn Jordan into an Islamist state. What are they supposed to think about U.S. assurances? Mm-hmm. What is Saudi Arabia supposed to think about U.S. assurances? I mean, the Saudis, strangely enough, are more in agreement with Israel than they are with the United States right now about what's going on in the Middle East.
Yes.
And what are they supposed to make about U.S. assurances? And let me tell you something. Why do you think the price of oil is as high as it is right now? The Saudis had said that they were going to pump enough oil to make up for the disruptions and try to soothe the oil market, which is right now worried about what's going on in Libya and worried about what's going on elsewhere in the Arab world. So the Saudis at one point said that they would start pumping more to make up for any questions or doubts, but they haven't. And one of the main reasons I believe they haven't is because they're sending a message to the Obama administration that the Saudis are very unhappy with the foreign policy of the United States right now, undermining Mubarak, for instance. And they're not going to lower the price of oil. And this is hurting the Obama administration. So they are essentially telling Obama that he needs to change his foreign policy or else the price of oil is going to keep on going up and the price of gasoline is going to keep on going up, which is very bad for a politician who is expecting to run for re-election.
What a tangled web we weave.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, you know, we hear a lot about Israel these days. We hear a lot about, actually I have two questions, but they're separate. You know, the Palestinians always forever being portrayed as the underdog. I don't think that's true anymore. And now Israel being set up, this talk going around about Israel being set up. What can you say about that?
Well, it was an effort a long time ago by the Arabs to try to remove the Arabs from the picture and just focus on Israel versus the Palestinians to try to reverse David versus Goliath, right? When it was the Arab countries openly talking about destroying Israel, then the Arab countries were Goliath, and there was, little Israel, which was David. But the Arab countries at some point recognized that and decided to try to make it not the Arabs against Israel, but Israel against the Palestinians, and the Palestinians would be David, and Israel would be Goliath. So this has been an ongoing process to try to do that. And, you know, it accelerates. I mean, the stuff that we talked about earlier about human rights groups and NGOs going in, that's all part of that. That's all part of trying to delegitimize Israel, portray it as the world's worst violator of human rights. This is true at the UN, of course, where until recently Libya sat on the Human Rights Council that was condemning Israel. Libya, Gaddafi, was sitting in judgment of Israel.
Right.
This is the kangaroo court world that we live in, where mm-hmm. up is down and, you know, everything is reversed.
That's exactly
I mean, that's
it.
What Israel has faced.
Exactly.
The big question is, are ethics and values, are dying forever, or we will have any hope soon?
Well, that always comes down to leadership.
Right.
And if leadership stresses those things, then they become important again. If it simply becomes ignored, and countries like the United States and Britain, and France,
and Germany,
don't act with in the name of facts and justice and ethics, then it's not going to happen.
I think Alex Safian, this comes from the ignorance about history, the leaving history out, all of the history. I believe that used to be an important study and important in the reporting of journalistic integrity is no longer there. The aspect of history.
The history that they're learning, unfortunately, is the wrong history. I mean, I can tell you that we recently saw, just as an example, and it's, some of this is up on our website at camera.org, where people can go see it. The LA Times just did a series a few days ago about Israel, yet another story about Israel by its reporter, Edmund Sanders, in which the history that he relies upon is from a former Israeli academic named Ilan Pape, who is one of the worst liars about Israel imaginable. He just churns out propaganda about Israel that, I've looked at some of his work and checked out some of his footnotes, et cetera. And, with a university historian, you don't expect that if you check out the footnotes that they turn out to be fake. In other words, that the source doesn't say what he claims. But yet that's the case with Pape. I mean, I remember looking at things where he was referring to something in Ben-Gurion's diaries. Ben-Gurion's diaries have never been published in English. They're in Hebrew. So he, writing in English, says Ben-Gurion said such and such and gives a citation. Well, we went back, we took out the diaries from the library, and we checked, and that's not what Ben-Gurion said. Ben-Gurion said the opposite. But if you're writing in English and citing something in Hebrew, not so easy to check, so he can get away with things. In fact, I remember one of these so-called new historians, of which Pape is the worst, had the same book written in English and in Hebrew, but they said different things. In Hebrew, where he couldn't really get away with lying about what something in the archive said, because the archive was in Hebrew, he said one thing. In English, where most of his readers would have no idea, would not be able to go to the archives in Jerusalem, etc., he said something very different. And so a friend of ours, Ephraim Karsh, who is a professor of history in Britain until recently, he was the chairman of the department at King's College, read the book in Hebrew at first, and then later on read the book in English and thought, wait a minute, that's not what it said in Hebrew. And he went back and he checked, and he's the one who discovered this, that it said one thing in Hebrew and something completely different in English. And the only interpretation is, in English you can get away with more. And so many of these journalists read these histories by the so-called new historians, which put Israel in the dock and try to convict it of ethnic cleansing, of having expelled the Palestinians in 1948, of having a plan to expel them, etc. And so the picture that is painted is that even in the 1940s, before Israel was an independent country, there was this powerful IDF funded and armed by the West, which of course is completely untrue,
absolutely,
that expelled the poor Palestinians, as if Israel was some sort of superpower out of the gate. Not that it was attacked by five Arab armies plus the Palestinians, but that the IDF just rolled over the poor Arabs who just wanted peace and expelled the Palestinians. And this is what many of the journalists believe, because these are the books that they read. These are the books that get published. And this is the so-called new history that's been written, which is a complete fiction, much of it. Which attempts to portray Israel as an ethnic cleanser and the worst human rights suppressor.
I could say something about some other people who are trying to recreate a new history, but I guess I'll keep my mouth shut. I wonder, we've got about 3 minutes. I wonder somehow we could sum this up. We love speaking to you, Mr. Alex Safian of camera.org, and maybe we'll have you on again with so much to say.
Well, thank you.
Maybe you could sort of give us sort of a wrap it up. Give us a sense of where is Western culture going? Are we going down the road of some kind of propaganda world? Some kind of hypothetical world, or where are we going? What is the future of our values?
It's always a fight, and people have to stand up for the truth. It's as simple as that. If people stand up for the truth and fight against this rewriting of history, fight on the local level, and make sure that the books in your in local schools are historically accurate, and not just about Israel, but about everything. About the United States, for instance, and if they're not, then you do something about it, because parents maybe don't have the time to look that closely at these books and what is being taught in the schools, and so teachers can get away with it. Look, the same thing happened in Israel. The textbooks were rewritten in Israel in a very, very negative way about 10 years ago. It came out. Yoram Hazoni actually was the one at Shalem, was the one who discovered this and publicized it, and was actually able to get it changed because Israeli parents had no idea what was going on, and were horrified to see that Israel was portrayed as the aggressor in 1948 or 1967. And there are enough Israelis who are old enough who lived through those days who know what the history is. They don't have to look in a history book. And to see that their kids were being taught this horrified them. And so once it became public, something was done about it. I think the same thing can happen here and has happened here. So people just have to get involved at a local level even, and changes can happen.
Education being key.
Education absolutely is important. I say this, that Israel is in many ways the most progressive country in the world. If other countries were faced with the terrorism that Israel is faced with, I fear to think what they would do, what we would do if we were faced with that kind of terrorism. If, God forbid, buses started to get blown up in California or in New York on a regular basis, the way they were in New York, in Israel, in Jerusalem, God knows what would happen. But in Israel, buses got blown up by Arabs. Did Arabs get lynched in Israel? No.
In fact,
it never
happened. In fact, Arabs are living very well these days. They are
absolutely not
heads
just
of
Arabs,
departments, doctors,
absolutely.
Lawyers, all sorts.
That's
of
correct.
Knesset members.
Yes, and so Israel is the most tolerant, progressive country in the world. It's unimaginable how a country under the pressure and threats, a tiny country under the pressure and threats that Israel is under, can behave the way it does. And yet even Israelis don't understand this. They don't understand that if this kind of terrorism happened in other countries, the reaction would be totally different.
Right.
And not as ethical and as tolerant and progressive as it is in Israel. And that's something that needs to be stressed. Israel is portrayed as the worst human rights aggressor in the world, an oppressor in the world. It actually has the best human rights record in the world. And that's something that we need to keep in mind, and we need to say publicly over and over again until it starts to penetrate.
Alex Safian, it's been really, really wonderful. We've run out of time, unfortunately, and maybe we'll have you again, as I said before. Tell people how they can contact. We've said it a number of times, but tell us how they can find you and get in touch with Camera and how they can become active.
Well, thank you very much for that. The website is www.camera.org. And the number in the office is 617-789-3672. We have various ways of getting involved, including an activist letter writer group that people might be interested in joining.
Oh, okay. So I will encourage our listeners to, again, that's camera, www.camera.org. You can call the office at 617-789-3672, correct?
That's it.
And Alex Safian, thank you so much for being
with
us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure. Great being with you.
Thank you.
Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom.
We are Rachel and Sonia. We actually don't have a Torah portion this week. We just wanted to remind people. Right, it's Passover.
It's
We're
Passover.
Celebrating Pesach.
So?
And it started all in Egypt, come out of Egypt, and we see the realities today and how relevant the Torah is.
This is because the Haggadah, it is a metaphor to to our own actual life today.
Amen. And Shabbat Shalom. We are Rachel and Sonia. This is Israel is Real. Our theme song, Hinei Matov, is by myself, Rachel, rachelmusic.com. We're on the air every Friday, 10 to 11 a.m. on the radio, WSMN 1590 Nashua's News and Talk. George, we would like to thank you for being our technician every week.
My pleasure, and a happy Easter.
And happy Easter, too. And this is Israel is Real.
Shabbat Shalom.